Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to talk now about the history of the Federal Reserve. And current Fed Chair Janet Yellen provided us with the perfect opportunity to do so because this morning she was on Capitol Hill testifying before the House Financial Services Committee.
At this point, I see the U.S. economy as performing well.
Yellen said that the Fed expects to see improvements in the labor market and that the economy could hit the Fed's 2% target rate for inflation.
And if the incoming information supports that expectation, then our statement indicates that December would be a live possibility, but importantly, that we've made no decision about it.
In other words, in the tortured, cautious language of the Fed, the central bank could raise rates by the end of the year. So markets will remain on tenterhooks until December at least. But how exactly did we get to this place where one institution, even one person, the Fed chair, has so much power over the economy? Well, that history is the subject of Boston-based journalist Roger Lowenstein's new book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. And Roger Lowenstein joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Meghna, thanks very much. And I'll try not to be tortured and cautious.
No. thank goodness, because oracular pronouncements from the Fed chair are one thing. But before we get into the deep history, which is absolutely fascinating, can we literally spend just 1 minute on a Federal Reserve 101? Because it's one of those institutions which everybody kind of claims they know something about, but I think few people really understand exactly how it works.
Sure. So the easy answer is if you take a dollar bill out of your wallet, it'll say Federal Reserve note in front of it, right? The money comes from the Fed, and it decides how much of that stuff is going to be circulating and how much, what would be too much. The slightly deeper answer is just as people go to banks, banks need a bank. The Federal Reserve is the banker to banks. So when it lends more money to banks and adds to their reserves, banks have more to lend to the economy, to all of us workers and businesses and everything. And that adds to liquidity, perhaps adds to prices and inflation and so on, and stimulates the economy.
Where does the Fed get its money?
The Fed literally has a printing press. It can create reserves. It is Ben Bernanke once said there's virtually no limit. There is no limit to what we could do. Way back when, it was limited by the amount of gold that was in the vaults, but that's not true anymore. Right now, the Fed is limited only by its discretion.
I see. Okay, yeah. So it is sort of the epicenter of our fractional reserve lending system.
Well said.
It makes me sound smarter than I really am. Okay, so how did we get here? Because prior to 1913, there was no Federal Reserve Bank.
That's right. So, and America then was the only industrial nation without one. Britain had one, France had one, Russia had one, Japan had one. And we alone, and we didn't have one. You sort of have to answer the question, how do we get to the point where we didn't have one before you get to how do we get to the point where we had one? We had this phobia going back to Thomas Jefferson that banks were bad, big banks were bad, big government was bad. And this is the original a conflict that he and Alexander Hamilton got in over federalism. Alexander Hamilton wanted a nation's bank. Jefferson said no. We had a couple of experiments very early in our history, and they were both abolished by Jefferson or his followers, Andrew Jackson in the second case.
And so this sort of love-hate relationship with the Fed goes back, as you're saying, to the concept of it, to the founding of the country. It's still with us today, and I do want to talk about that with you in a minute, Roger, But the actual circumstances around the creation of the Fed in 1913, as you write in your book, America's Bank, are absolutely fascinating. What was happening to the American economy in the late 19th, early 20th century that finally made people realize we need a central bank?
So there was a lot of unrest about the monetary situation, about whether there was enough money circulating. Farmers were very unhappy because we had 30 years of deflation in this country. That is to say, prices went lower and lower and lower 30 years in a row. You can imagine being a farmer, you borrow money, your crops sell for less next year. The year after that, they sell for even less. They were very unhappy. On the other hand, bankers were not so unhappy. There wasn't much – money was scarce. Interest rates were high. We had a lot of conflict. But the seeming solution of a central bank was off the table. It was like a political third rail. because of our history going back to Jefferson and Jackson. Americans had this sort of phobia. Yeah. I think going back to the American Revolution, this idea would be recreating the sort of thing we rebelled against in England if we created a powerful center. What finally got the ball rolling, we had a series of panics, money panics, depressions. In 1907, we had a really bad money panic that just banks just started closing down.
They literally had no money.
We literally had bank runs. People would literally run to the bank, demand money back. They'd line up. If you were there early, you might have gotten your deposits out. If you weren't, tough luck. It started in New York. It spread from weak banks to healthy banks in New York. Then it spread to other cities across the country. And there was no Ben Bernanke. There was no Janet Yellen. There was no lender of last resort to come in and say, enough, I'm going to start lending because nobody else is lending. At that point, people realized, although they weren't sure what the solution was, that the existing system didn't work.
Right, and it's interesting because the American economy itself was undergoing this major transition from an agricultural economy to a more industrial one. There we were seeing, you know, as we enter the teens and, of course, the 20s, the rapid consolidation of wealth in the Gilded Age. I mean, like, when you think about it.
Very much an issue. Inequality.
Yeah, it sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
People were angry at banks. They were angry at bankers. All very familiar.
So there are some key players in your story as you tell about the founding of the Fed. Can we just talk briefly about some of them? Senator Nelson Aldrich, first of all, from Rhode Island.
So, yeah, he's right in this neck of the woods, Rhode Island senator, quintessential late 19th century Gilded Age senator, very much a representative of manufacturing interests, a business, didn't really care about the common person. By the way, senators in that day and age were elected by the legislatures.
There was no direct election.
So he didn't really have to worry about the common man. He was pretty much reviled in these progressive era cartoons. You see pictures of him with money spilling out of his pockets. That's the way cartoonists portrayed him. Late in life, he had a change in heart. After this panic, he had been a defender of the status quo. He realized the banking system was lacking something, and he went to Europe on a fact-finding tour. And people thought he was just sort of sweeping things under the rug, and this fact-finding tour was a fig leaf. But he took it seriously. He talked to dozens and dozens of bankers in foreign countries. Everywhere, when he asked the question, what do you do about panics? What do you do about bank runs? He heard the answer, we don't have them, because here our banks know they can always borrow from the central bank. And he came back a changed man.
And there's a meeting off the coast of Georgia on a secret island.
Okay, Megan, this is the part where the story
I'm not wearing a tinfoil hat.
No.
Like,
now
really.
Is the place where the story gets hijacked by Hollywood scriptwriters. But except it wasn't. It's true. There's so much opprobrium directed at bankers after this panic. And yet Aldrich, who now wants to write a bill for a central bank, but realizes that if the public knows he's doing that, if Wall Street's involved, he'll be ridden out of town on a rail. So he decides to do it in secret. He invites three of the top bankers in the country to go down on his private rail car. They go from New York all the way to Georgia. They're dressed ridiculously as if they're going on a hunting party. One of them is carrying a shotgun with cartridges. They wouldn't even know which way to point it. And they go off to a private club where J.P. Morgan has cleared everybody else out. And for a week, nobody, not their family, not their secretaries, not the people in their companies know, and they write what becomes the first draft of the eventual Federal Reserve Act in utter secrecy.
Wow. You know, and in your book, you also write about President Woodrow Wilson as being quite a statesman in order, because opprobrium is the word you used earlier, and I think that's absolutely true. And yet, you know, there were so many opposing forces around this idea of the Fed, and yet, come 1913, we actually get a Federal Reserve created.
Wilson is a very strong figure. I'm glad you brought him up because I think Americans tend to remember the older Wilson.
The failed
foreign policy guy. This Wilson had just been elected in 1912. He had electrified the country, relatively young, full of ideals, former college president. And he's able to both make the tough decisions and the tough compromises. At one point, he's still president-elect, Carter Glass, a Southern congressman, brings him a plan for a new reserve system. And Wilson looks at it, and because Carter Glass is a Southern Democrat opposed to any sort of federal intervention, the plan just consists of 20 different reserve centers around the country, no link between them, no federal role at all. And Wilson, who's after all a student of history himself, says, this is fine, but we need to centralize this thing. We need to have what he called a capstone. that capstone drew into the Federal Reserve. He goes on to make several other key decisions that shape the bill, and then he really has muscle in getting it through Congress.
Right.
There's a Lyndon Johnson side to Woodrow Wilson, at least in his younger years. He's quite forceful and he's quite effective.
So this is a story of how, people who are politically opposed to one another, very, very strong. I mean, even William Jennings Bryan eventually becomes a supporter of the Fed. They come together and manage to create this new institution. Do you think anything like that could happen today?
You know, I kept thinking that as I wrote the book. I just want to refer to one compromise in particular, because they've got a draft of the Fed. And the people in the Federal Reserve Board in this draft are all going to be bankers, chosen by bankers. And William Jennings Bryan, of course, great populist, great or terrible, depending on your politics, but he's a populist. He's in Wilson's cabinet because he really helped make Wilson president. He says this won't fly. If we're going to have this new institution supervising the banking system, the people in the Federal Reserve Board have to be public. They have to be political appointees. And Wilson makes that switch. Bankers, of course, are horrified that they are now going to be reporting, their industry is going to be supervised by public appointees. But kicking and screaming, they go along with it. That was the type of compromise that Wilson forced down their throats. He also pushed back at the other side, pushed back at the farmers and so on. At the end of the day, despite truly deep conflicts between bankers and farmers, Republicans and Democrats, people here in the Northeast and people out west and down south, they got through a workable and salutary and enduring solution. You ask, can we still do this today? And, you know, I hope they look at this era as a model, because I think we've lost a lot of that ability.
I mean, and the Fed is a primary target for modern-day opprobrium.
There are bills. You know, the Fed has a terrible reputation. And by the way, I've said that if they had failed to rescue the system, I could understand it. But they're really hated and vilified because they stepped in and saved the system. And there are bills up and down Congress today to strip it of what power it has now.
Well, the book is America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. It is an absolutely fascinating read. Roger Lowenstein wrote it, and he joined us here in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Magna, it was a real pleasure to be talking to you.
Great to talk to you as well. Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. See you again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.